these narrations, which though have a very weak chain, which are not considered to be very, very authentic. However, you shed a light on them, the content of the narrations, and you told us that even if Imam is going to demolish these mosques, he is going to demolish the part of land that was taken, unfortunately, by force after Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. We pray for the reappearance of Imam, may Allah hasten his reappearance so that, inshallah, Imam will soon fill the world with justice, give rights to the people whose rights were, in fact, their rights were taken away. Allahumma ajjal li waliyika al-faraj. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to The Last Savior.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the Americans, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, you know, following on from their experiences in 1945. The British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
The UK, alongside the US, invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009, but no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
London is one of Saudi Arabia's staunch supporters. UK-made weapons are used by the Saudi regime against the Yemeni people. The UK is one of Saudi Arabia's leading arms suppliers, along with the US. It is also a major supplier of arms to the United Arab Emirates, another country in the coalition that is bombing Yemen. The UK has continued to support airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. It has provided both arms and ongoing maintenance and support, in spite of overwhelming evidence of repeated breaches of international humanitarian law by the coalition.
Well, its colonial interest is historical. I don't believe that anyone is trying to get Lawrence of Arabia back into the peninsula anymore. I don't think the British, even the most purblind British, don't think they can recreate the empire.
The UK-made equipment used in the war includes Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Paveway bombs, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles. The published value of UK armed licenses for export to the Saudi-led coalition since the bombing began in 2015, in March, is £8.4 billion. However, estimates show that the real value of arms to Saudi Arabia is over £20 billion, while the value of sales to the coalition as a whole is over £22 billion.
Such hideous weaponry, and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
It is now believed that given the U.S. withdrawal from the West Asia region, or minimal presence, the U.K. is moving in to replace the U.S. while pursuing to restore its colonial influence and role in the West Asia region.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile its entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts in its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Previously, retired Israeli General Yitzhak Brek warned that the Israeli military is not ready for any future war, especially a multi-front one. He predicted that in an extreme scenario, the resistance movements in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, as well as Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will launch missiles and drones at Israel, so that the average number of rockets fired at the regime will reach 3,000 a day. Add to it reports during the Israel-Palestine conflict in May, when Israel's official military data indicated that the Iron Dome only destroyed fewer than half of the rockets and mortars fired by Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements toward Israel. Therefore, in case of an all-out war, the Israeli regime would be vulnerable. While Tel Aviv sees its power waning, the resistance front has managed to increase its prowess. This is while Israel is trying to sell the Iron Dome missile system to Arab nations, but how can the Iron Dome work for them when it did not work for Israel?
This is why the entire existence of the so-called state of Israel in its current form necessitates the ongoing killing of people and ongoing expansion of its military complex. But at the same time, of course, it remains fragile. This is a very existential contradiction within the Israeli colony that eventually will also probably lead to its to the fall of the apartheid regime and the Israeli hegemony, supposed hegemony in the region.
The editor-in-chief of Rayal Yom newspaper, Abdel Bari Atwan, says a small drone that is worth only $100 manages to penetrate into Israel's airspace, despite the Tel Aviv regime's costly military equipment and the Iron Dome system. He says Persian Gulf Arab states that are racing to buy this system from Israel should give it a second thought after the regime's failure against the Hezbollah resistance movement's drones. World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises. The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, its economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
In the limelight.
The real threat against the U.S. is that of detached politicians who are amassing wealth, fighting for power and prestige, while their countrymen and women continue to go hungry, says Ramzi Baruth, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden's real challenge is not Russia or China, but poverty in America. Here's the story. Mainstream U.S. media continues to celebrate the supposed strength of the U.S. economy.
Almost daily, headlines speak of hopeful numbers, sustainable growth, positive trends, and constant gains. The reality on the ground, however, tells of something entirely different, which raises the question, are Americans being lied to? And for what purpose? U.S. economy grew 1.7% in fourth quarter, capping a strong year, the New York Times reported. U.S. economy grew 5.7% in 2021, fastest full-year clip, the Washington Post added. Reuters, Voice of America, the Financial Times, CNN, MarketWatch, and many others all concurred. But if that is the case, why then is U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating at an all-out-time low? And why are many Americans literally going hungry? In a national opinion poll conducted by Reuters Ipsos and published on February 3rd, only 41% of U.S. adults approved of Biden's performance in office. A whopping 56% disapproved. The numbers were not a complete shock, as the downward trajectory of the Biden presidency has been in effect soon after he moved to the White House over a year ago. The truth is, Biden was not the Democrats' top choice nominee for president. Judging by various opinion polls and the early results of the Democratic primaries in 2020, it was Bernie Sanders who represented the Democratic hope for real, substantive change. Party politics, liberal media insistence that Sanders was not electable, and fear-mongering regarding a second Trump term in office pushed Biden through the ranks of nominees to be presented as America's only hope for salvation. While Republicans remain committed to the Donald Trump's legacy and are still largely politically and ideologically united, Democrats are growingly unconfident in their leadership and uncertain regarding the future of their democracy, governance, and economy. Of course, they are blameless in holding such views. While the Democratic leadership continues to obsess with its fear of Trump, and while liberal media insists that the U.S. economy is as healthy as it can be, the average American continues to struggle against encroaching poverty, inflation, and lack of future prospects. Here are some of sobering numbers. 56% of all Americans cannot produce a meager $1,000 as an emergency expense from their existing savings, CNBC reported. 1 in 10 U.S. adults have gone hungry last December as a result of poverty, Forbes.com reported. Columbia University Center on Poverty and Social Policy revealed that child poverty rate in the United States stands at 17%, one of the highest among developed countries. If American workers are studied separately from the larger population, the numbers are even more grim. 3/4 of American workers said that it was very or somewhat difficult to make ends meet, according to a study conducted by Shift Project and reported in NBC News Online. 40% of the polled workers said they're not able to come up with $400 in emergency money. But the most shocking of all, according to the same study, is that around 20% said they went hungry because they shouldn't and couldn't afford enough to eat. Aside from occasional government handouts, which were provided by both the Trump and Biden administrations, little has been done by way of structural changes to the U.S. economy that would ensure greater equality among all sectors of society. Instead, the administration's priorities seem to be allocated to something else entirely. Writing in Politico, David Siders describes the current political discourse within Democratic Party circles where Democrats are losing their minds over 2024. Since the Democratic president's public approval ratings are dismal, Democrats fear the return of Trump. All anyone can talk about is Trump, donors, policy folks, party insiders, and the media. Siders quoted a Democratic advisor as saying the same advisor described a weird cycle where the conversation keeps coming back to Trump. Whether conscious of this obsession or not, the Biden administration seems to operate entirely according to a political strategy that is predicted on tarnishing Trump and his supporters, retelling over and over again the story of the January 6th insurrection, hoping for a Republican split or any other miracle that would bolster their chances of maintaining their congressional majority in the next November amid term elections. While doing so, the Democratic leadership seems oblivious to the harsh reality on the ground, where food prices are skyrocketing and where inflation has reached unbearable levels. According to new data released on February 10th by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose by 7.5% in January compared to the same month a year ago, making it the fastest annual pace since 1982, the Financial Times reported. The rise in inflation is not a one-time-off event, as CPI has been rising at a sustainable level of 0.6% on a monthly basis. Ordinary people can feel this increase almost every time they go shopping. Small business owners, especially restaurants, bakeries, and grocery stores, are left with one out of two options, either increasing their prices or shutting down completely. Consequently, large segments of the already vulnerable U.S. population are growing more desperate than ever. To avoid providing real answers to difficult questions about the welfare of millions of Americans, about the real function of their democratic institutions, and about existing corruption within the U.S. political system, regardless of who controls the Congress or resides in the White House, Democrats and their media are either blaming their Republican rivals or creating foreign policy distractions.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Parenting Pathology. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of parenting pathology in the Islamic lifestyle. One of the issues that we see in the Islamic lifestyle, especially when we talk about the family and the family life, we see that we are unaware of the parenting pathology. And if we are unaware of the damages or the dangers which is waiting for the family through the training maybe, or through not training the kids, or do not being attentive towards the importance of the training, there are many, many things that can happen, and it can destroy the structure of the family. Therefore, it is very necessary to be aware of the parenting pathology in order to have a good family life and in order to raise the kids in a good way or train them in the best way. Therefore, it is necessary. And when we talk about the parenting pathology, there are different things under this topic which we will explain, inshallah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of parenting pathology, and we said there are different things that come under this topic. And the first thing that we should be aware of it is the loss of the authority of the parents over their kids when they are training them or raising them according to the Islamic teachings. There are many times that we are unaware of such loss, and therefore when our kids are at an age where they need us, where they need this religious training, where they need us to teach them the Islamic teachings, and when we are not paying attention towards them, later on this authority that we have over them, under which we can teach them the Islamic lifestyle, under which we can make them someone who has been raised according to the Islamic teachings, this authority is lost and they no more following us, and this is a big damage to the family lifestyle, especially to the Islamic lifestyle. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
What unites all settler colonial regimes, but particularly the US and Israel, is the commonality of structural racism, says Binay Bland, political commentator, in an article titled Evictions in Sheikh Jarrah. If housing is a human right, whose rights really matter? Stay tuned for more. In 1948, the United States signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, UDHR, acknowledging satisfactory housing as part of the human right to an adequate standard of living. Nevertheless, soon after the recent end of the moratorium, evictions slowly began to rise. What unites all settler colonial regimes, but particularly the U.S. and Israel, is the commonality of structural racism. Indeed, the latest uprising in Palestine stemmed from efforts to evict residents of Sheikh Jarrah in order to replace them with Israeli settlers. It is this structural racism on the part of the Zionist regime that lends the liberation struggle to its international anti-colonial cast. Observers Onye Snow Chatoyer, an organizer with the African People's Revolutionary Party and the All African Women's Revolutionary Union, an editor with Hood Communist, also serving on the National Committee of the Ven Saramos Brigade, said, "From the very first days of its birth, born from a wave of African and indigenous blood, the United States has built its empire on the backs of the masses of poor and colonized people inside and outside of its borders. According to the Eviction Lab, nearly one in four black renters lives in a country in which the black eviction rate is more than double the white eviction rate. Moreover, formal eviction proceedings are only a part of the problem. As Sophie Kasowich notes, many tenants are illegally locked out or their utilities are shut off, thus forcing them to leave their homes." A case in point drawn from a forthcoming press release and Facebook post on February 5th, 2022, Asaneta Nekormotore, a long-term community organizer in Philadelphia, an anti-Zionist friend of Palestine, received a 30-day notice to vacate the home that she had been renting for several years. A short time later, some of the new owner's family members started moving in a while. She's still in the house, using a fraudulent lease with different language than the one she signed. The new owner declared that Nekormotore is now a month-to-month housemate, confined to the bedroom rather than the entire house. Nekormotore said, "We need a stronger good cause legislation in Philadelphia. Without it, landlords can sell their property, make a tremendous profit, and push renters out using a move-in eviction, where the new tenant moves in while the current tenant is still there, using implied threats and other forms of intimidation to force the current tenant out. This is very dangerous and has a great potential for violence." In the United States, tenants like Nekormotore have access to the legal system, albeit that it often does not work in their favor. In Sheikh Jarrah, where Ramzi Barut reports that Israel uses the law to ethnically cleanse Palestinians, there is no such recourse to the courts. As Barut points out, this most recent ethnic cleansing has a long history, justified through a series of laws unique to Israel, laws that give a legal cover to outright theft and land robbery. Indeed, after a month-long physical and legal battle to avoid eviction, four Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah received the Zionist regime's court's decision that could stay in their homes for 15 years as protected residents. As such, they were required to pay the new Jewish owners a biennial sum of 2,400 shekels, amounting to $743. There are major differences between illegal evictions in Al-Quds neighborhoods as a cover for ethnic cleansing and rising evictions in the states. Nevertheless, what unites them is communal resistance to what Chyotr describes as settler colonial violence. From Gaza to Al-Quds and the West Bank, Palestinians participated in what came to be known as the Unity Intifada. "This unity eclipses Fatah and Hamas and all the rest," wrote Barud, adding, "because without a united people, there can be no meaningful resistance, no vision for liberation, no struggle for justice to be won." Moreover, Barud contends that the uprising that was instigated by the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah was but a microcosm of a larger issue. The ongoing atrocities in Palestine date back to 1948 and continue to this day, but so does the resistance. In Philadelphia, friends responded to Nekor Matura's call on social media for support in the face of eviction by intimidation. On February 7th, she wrote, "If you want to witness a possible illegal move in eviction, come to my house tomorrow, Monday, February 7th. A group of supporters has been present since Monday, February 7th, and will continue to support her as she faces move-out intimidation. As in Palestine, the response was communal. Members of the Poor People's Army and Friends, who represented various activist organizations, arrived to ensure Nekorma Torres' safety. Another commonality is that she represents only one case study of infringement on housing rights of people all over the country, a crisis that looms larger as landlords seek to obtain high rents in a booming housing and rental market." In Palestine, the motive behind evictions is ethnic cleansing. In the U.S., it is disregard for what are considered disposable people whose rights matter less in a capitalist economy than those who reap high profits. What unites them is global resistance movements to settler colonial regimes. This kind of solidarity is crucial to Palestine's liberation. While Palestinians have proved that they are quite capable of saving themselves, collaboration with the Global South, which includes Black Americans, is an important step in the liberation struggle towards freedom.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics.
all produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our fiqh, our jurisprudence, our social knowledge, our humanities, our political and our different methods should improve on a daily basis. However, these components should be handled by skilled individuals, by experts, by those who are good at thinking, by those who have the qualifications to introduce new methods. Half-educated and incompetent individuals and those who make extravagant claims cannot accomplish anything. This topic should receive attention. All these issues are on a path that can deviate to the left or to the right. Therefore, we should take the middle of the path. Supporting unprivileged classes of the people is also important. One of the main principles and values of the Islamic Republic is supporting unprivileged classes. Another important role in supporting the oppressed wherever they are in the world. These are the main values of the revolution, and they cannot be sidelined. If someone, some people, and some orientation are indifferent to unprivileged classes and to the oppressed people among the world, they're missing criteria.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, if this commitment to fundamental values, this was the first criterion, exists, the movement will be a continuous and a straight movement, one that will not change in the whirlwind of events. However, if this commitment does not exist, the opposite, which is excessive pragmatism, will occur. This means taking a different direction every day. It means that every event can drag us this way and that. The temptations of this or that and my own whims drag me to different directions like a blade or straw. This is pragmatism, which means being included towards different sides on a daily basis. This contradicts the commitment that I spoke about. In the Holy Quran, this commitment to values has been referred to as steadfastness. Therefore, be steadfast as you are commanded. You and those with you turn unto Allah. Holy Quran, chapter 11, verse 112. This is a Quranic ayah and verse from the Holy Surah Hud.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. I want to thank you for
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalized their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
EU foreign affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way she's consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Tuesday, the Italian Bureau of Statistics, Istat, announced Italy's inflation surged to 4.8% last month from 3.9% in December and is now at its highest since 1996. The statistical agency said its trolley index of everyday goods, such as food and household items, was up 3.2% with the Italians starting to buckle under the pressure. Price rises, Istat explained, were driven by higher energy costs.
Bread, milk, pasta, the price of every item has gone up considerably. I go shopping every day and it cannot go unnoticed.
Energy bills have gone up for a while and keeping the shop open is becoming unsustainable. In December I paid almost 100% more compared to the previous bill. I'm really concerned over what's happening in Ukraine. Should energy prices further hike, I would have to turn off the lights or shut off the shop.
Tension keeps growing at the border of the EU and Russia after Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent. Western leaders have vowed to impose severe sanctions over Moscow aimed at limiting Russia's ability to export oil and gas. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has warned that any international sanctions targeting Russia's energy industry would hit Italy badly. Unlike other major European countries, Rome is very much gas-dependent, being the leading producer of electricity with this fuel in Europe.
Italy sources around 40% of its gas from Russia. As we are in February, with the warmer season fast approaching, the energy demand is set to drop a bit. It is to be hoped that the Ukraine crisis will be resolved in the next 6 to 7 months. In case it is not, the EU, which won't be self-sufficient in energy anytime soon, will have to find unity of purpose among its member states and embrace a more assertive energy strategy.
Rome has historically relatively strong commercial ties with Moscow. In recent days, Italy had announced plans for the possibility of Draghi flying to the Russian capital for talks over the Ukraine crisis with Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
The Ukraine crisis is entering a new phase as Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Putin has also issued an order to deploy peacekeepers to Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex the two regions. The Russian president justified his decision by accusing the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
They simply fooled us. We had 5 stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin reiterated that Kyiv's admission to NATO would pose a major security threat to his country. The comments provoked Kyiv's reaction.
Ukraine unequivocally qualifies the recent actions of the Russian Federation as a violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our state.
Hours later, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the situation. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. clashed head-to-head at the meeting.
The internationally recognized borders of Ukraine have been and will remain unchangeable, regardless of any statements and actions by the Russian Federation.
What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Russia has warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation, but the West's reaction was nothing other than critical.